She was not brought directly before Maethanet, as Esmanet had expected. Instead, she was delivered to a commandeered watch garrison for the remainder of the night. She was beaten, almost raped, and generally suffered the leering absence of pathos that often belongs to servants who hold their master's enemy. She did not sleep, nor was she unchained. She was forced to make water in her own clothes. Within a watch of dawn, a second company of Shrial knights arrived, these belonging to the Inchausti, the Shrier's own elite bodyguard. A dispute broke out, and somehow shouts turned into a summary execution, as well as the hasty flight of three of the men watching her. Resplendent in their golden mail, the Inchausti took her back into the streets. They at least treated her with decorum and respect, even if they failed to remove the chains. She had not the heart to beseech them, let alone speak at all, and so found her way to the accidental dignity that belongs to shock and exhaustion. She shuffled and stumbled in her ankle chains, a woman dwarfed in a shining column of armored men. It was still early morning, so that the sun touched naught but the sky, leaving the streets chill and gray. Despite this, more and more people gathered as they made their way toward Camiral, craning and sometimes jumping for a glimpse of her. "The Holy Empress!" she heard shouted in random broken choruses. And periodically, "The Whore!" The cries obviously outran their small formation, for every turn revealed more people, crowding the stoops, jostling with the Inchausti, in the streets, hanging their heads from windows and roofs, their eyes bleary with sleep and wonder. She saw all castes and callings, glimpsed faces that mourned, that celebrated, that exhorted her to be strong. They neither heartened nor repelled her. The knights of the Tusk shoved their way forward, bellowing warnings, cuffing or punching the insolent. More and more frustration and alarm replaced their expressions of studied concentration. The Inchausti's captain, a tall, silver-bearded man the Empress thought she recognized, finally commanded his company to unfasten their sheathed swords and use them as clubs. She witnessed firsthand how violence begets violence, and found that she did not care. Those behind them followed. Those before them called out, waking whole swaths of the city along their path, drawing more and more into the streets. The march had become a running battle by the time they turned on the processional, just to the west of the Rat Canal. The Merman knights continued to accumulate, their gall growing in proportion to their numbers. She saw many of them raising clay tablets that broke as she was hustled past, but whether they were curses or blessings, she did not know. Freed of the slotted streets, the Inchausti formed a ring about her. The Camiral opened before them, its expanses already hazy. It seemed all the world thronged within it, spread across the plazas, packed about the monumental bases. The black basalt facade of the Temple Zelthe loomed beyond the sea of faces and brandished fists, bathing in the morning heat. Pigeons took flight across the neighboring tenements. The Inchausti pressed forward without hesitation, perhaps buoyed by the sight of their fellows arrayed shining across the first landing beneath Zothe. Their progress was haphazard at best, despite the clubbing fury of the knights. Esmanet found herself looking across the mobs to their right, the obelisks of their past rulers rising like spear points from their seething midst. She glimpsed the face of Icuri Zarius III, raised to the climbing sun. Suffered a bizarre, almost nightmarish pang of nostalgia. She saw bands of men with Yatwer's sickle inked across their cheeks. She saw innumerable circumfixes, clutched in hands manicured, calloused, even poxed. The shouts resounded to the heavens, a kind of cackling roar, born of contradictory cries. Every other heartbeat, it seemed, she caught some fragment of whore or empress. Every other blink she glimpsed some Merman knight howling in adulation, or spitting hate. She saw men tangled in battling mobs, striking each other over the shoulders, reaching out to grab hair or tear clothes. She glimpsed a man stab another in the throat. The mob surged against the company, and for several moments they were overcome, broken into battling clots. Esmonet even felt hands clawing at her. Her gown was ripped from her shoulder to her elbow. The nameless captain bawled out, his battle-trained voice ringing through the din, commanding the Inshasti to draw their swords. Held fast in gauntleted hands, she saw the sunlight shimmer across the first raised blades, saw the blood rise in crimson winking strings and beads. Shouts became screams. The beleaguered company resumed its advance, now skidding on blood. Zathe climbed black and immovable above them, and somehow she knew that her brother-in-law awaited her in the cool gloom beyond the gilded doors. The holy Shrya of the Thousand Temples, her son's murderer. The entire time, from Inhalus's unceremonious murder to the stairs of Zathe, she had existed in a kind trance. Somehow she had floated while her body had walked. Even the riotous tumult, which had torn her clothes and thrown her to her knees on several occasions, happened as if seen from afar. None of it seemed real, somehow. But now, nothing could be more real than Maethanet. She thought of her husband's treatment of the Orthodox kings who fell into his power, Earl Usfringa of Nangale, whom he had blinded, then staked naked beneath Maegiri's southernmost gate, Xenius of Ampli, whom he had disemboweled before his shrieking children. Mercy meant nothing to Kellus, apart from its convoluted uses, and given the rigors of empire, cruelty was generally the more effective tool. Her brother-in-law was also Dunyane. What happened next depended entirely on her uses. And empresses, especially those who had to be discredited for power's sake, rarely found mercy. Palpable horror. Her body clamored as if seeking to shake free of itself. She was about to die. After all she had witnessed and survived, she thought of her children, each in succession. But she could only conjure their faces as little children and not as they were. Only Kel'Nomis stood fast in her soul's eye. She struggled to climb the steps. Her manacled feet were scarce able to clear each rise. She could feel as much as hear the rioting tracks behind her, the ardor of those who loved or hated, and the lechery of the curious. She stumbled, and her left arm slipped from the flanking knight's grasp. She chipped free and fell face forward, her wrists chained to her waist. Her shins skidded along unbeveled edges. Stone bludgeoned her ear and temple. But she did not so much feel her misstep as hear it, reflected in the mobs behind her. A thousand lungs gasping, a thousand throats chortling in glee. Momen and all its roaring vagaries, passing judgment on her humiliation. She tasted blood. The two Inshasti who had let her fall pulled her back to her feet with dreadful ease. With gauntlets jammed into her armpits, they carried her the remaining way. Something slumped within her, something as profound as life. And those watching could see that the blessed Empress of the Three Seas was at last deposed. Zathe's iron portal slowly ground shut behind her. She watched the oblong of light thrown across the floor shrink about her frail shadow. Then the doors shuttered all in gloom. Ringing ears, airy darkness, a kind of perfume dank, like flowers hung in a cellar. Clamor hummed out from the immense stonework hanging about her, an endless crashing. She knew the world dawned bright beyond the cyclopean walls, but she had the sense of standing in an ocean cavern, a place deeper than light. She began shuffling from the antechamber, out across the prayer floor, toward the great space beneath the central dome. The weight of her shackles bowed her, made burning effort out of mere walking. Pillars soared. Lantern wheels hung from chains throughout the interior, creating a false ceiling of circular lights. A fan of faint shadows followed her as she hobbled, rattling with every step. A dais the size of a small barge dominated the floor beneath the high dome. She numbly gazed at the ark of idols arrayed upon it. Wayne Onkis, fierce Gilgail, lewd Giera, bulbous Yatwer, and others, a tenth of the hundred, the eldest and the most powerful, cast in gold, shining and lifeless. She had learned their names with her mother's face, the souls that joined all souls. Her whole life she had known them, feared and adored them, and she had prayed to them. She had clutched her knees, sobbing their names. The broad-shouldered man who knelt in prayer beneath them, she had known for less than half her life, if indeed she had known him at all. She knew him enough only to know that he never prayed. Not truly. Anna Sarimba Mathanet, the holy shrier of the thousand temples. He turned the instant she came to a pause below, held her in his monolithic regard. He was dressed in full ceremonial splendor, with elaborate vestments hooding his shoulders, draping down in two long, gold-tasseled tongues. He had allowed his beard to grow so that the plaits fanned across his ritual chest-plate. They seemed to have stained the white felt of his vestments where they touched, as if he had used a cheaper dye than usual to conceal the blonde that was his true color. His hair gleamed with oils, making him seem of a piece with the idols framing him. She flinched at the deep bass of his voice. "The officers who beat you," he said. "They are being flayed even as we speak. Several others will be executed as well." He seemed genuinely apologetic, genuinely furious. Which was how she knew he lied. "Apparently," he continued, "they thought apprehending you without knowledge of their betters would earn them more glory in this world." His look was at once mild and merciless. "I have invited them to try the next." She never spoke, nor breathed for several long blinking moments. She wanted to scream. "My husband! Don't you realize Kellis will see you gutted?" Only to find her outrage robbed of voice by some perverse reflex. She began instead, coughing and blinking tears. "Where are my children?" Her face crumpled about a sob. So long she had toiled, feared. The Shrier of the Thousand Temples loomed above her, his manner cold and absolute. "The Empire is falling apart," he said in a voice fairly bottomless for its wisdom. "Why, Esme, why have you done this?"
"You killed my son!"
she heard herself shriek. "You killed your son, Esme, not me, when you directed his attempt on my life."
"I did not!"
she cried, her limbs thrown to the impotent limit of her chains. "I only needed to know if you were hiding anything. Nothing more, nothing less. You killed my son. You made this into a war. You!" Mathanet's face remained perfectly blank, though his eyes glittered with what seemed a wary cunning. "You believe what you're saying?" he finally said.
"Of course!"
Her voice pealed high and raw beneath the airy gloom of the domes, faded into the white hiss of the mob's roar. He gazed at her, and she had this curious sense of throwing herself open, as though her face had been a shuttered window. "Esme," he said far more softly. "I was mistaken, both in what I assumed to be your intentions, and in your capacity." She almost coughed for shock. Was this some kind of game? She thought she laughed when in fact she wept.
"You thought me mad, is that it?"
"I feared," he said. The Shrier of the Thousand Temples descended the steps, then, impossibly, knelt before her, raised a hand to her bloody cheek. He smelled of sandalwood and myrrh. He produced a small key from his girdle, crudely cast. Esmond reeled. She had assumed this audience would be nothing more than a pantomime, a ceremony required to stamp her inevitable execution with a semblance of legitimacy. She had hoped only to throw her defiance and her righteousness into the air between them, where memory could not deny it. She had forgotten that pride and vanity meant nothing to him. that he would never merely covet power for its own sake. That he was Dunyane. "Long nights, Esme," he said as he worked the lock on her manacles. And it seemed madness, the absence of embarrassment or contrition, or any other recognition of the absurdity between them. In a way, it seemed almost as terrifying as the doom she had originally expected. "Long nights have I pondered the events of the past months. And the question is always the same." One by one he cracked open the locks, beginning with her wrists, then bending to free her ankles. She found herself flinching from his powerful proximity, not bodily, but in her soul, which had feared him for too long to quickly relinquish its aversion. "What?" he asked as he worked. "What is my brother's plan?" The holy shrier looked up from the posture of a penitent. He must have known that the gods would begin clamoring against him, that one by one their far-off whispers would take root in the cults. He must have known his empire would crumble in his absence. So then why? Why would he entrust it all to someone with no Dunyane blood? "To me," she said with more bitterness than she intended. A roaring swell rose from the rioters beyond the walls, a reminder that for all the temple's immensity, it was but a small pocket of gloom in a world of sunlit war. A reminder of the people they would command. "Please, Esme," he said, standing to gaze down into her eyes. "I beg you, set aside your pride. Listen as your husband would listen without prejudice," she interrupted, drawing her lips into a sour line. "Continue." She gingerly rubbed her wrists, blinking in the manner of those with sand in their eyes. She could not see her way past her shock and incredulity. A simple misunderstanding? Was that it? How many people had died? How many men like Imhalis? "Out of all his tools," Mathenet said, "I have long known that ignorance is the one he finds most useful. Even still, I succumb to the vanity that bedevils all men. I thought I was the lone exception. Me, another son of Anasarimba Moengus, one who knows the treacherous ways of conviction. The way certainty is simply an illusion born of ignorance. I convinced myself that my brother chose your hands, which were both weak and unwilling, because he had deemed me a threat. Because he did not trust where the Logos might lead me. For all the disorder of her soul, these words burned with peculiar clarity, probably because she had rehearsed them with such morbid frequency. The way he did not trust your father," she said. A grave nod, steeped in admission. "Yes, like my father. Perhaps even because of my father. I thought he might have suspected I possessed residual filial passions. That you would betray him to avenge your father." "No, nothing so crude as that. You would be dismayed as me to know the way caprice and vanity distort the intellect. Men ever cast themselves into labyrinths of thinking, not to lose themselves in the pursuit of truth, but to hide their self-interest in subtleties, and so make noble their crassest desires. Thus does avarice become charity, and vengeance justice." It was as if a drawstring had been yanked tight about her breast. "You convince yourself that Kellis feared the same of you?" "Yes," he said. "And why not? When men so regularly yoke their intelligence to self-serving stupidity. I am half a man. But the interdiction, the questions it raised, plagued me, even as I acted in ways I thought my brother would demand of me. Why? Why would he forbid all communication between the great ordeal and a new empire?" She glanced at the shackles discarded at her feet, noticed a bead of blood welling from one of her toes. "Because he feared that tidings of discord would weaken the ordeal's resolve." This at least had been what she told herself, what she needed to believe. "But then why would he cease communicating?" Mathenet asked, Why would he personally refuse to answer our pleas? From his brother, from his wife. She did not know. The Holy Empress of the Three Seas wiped at the tears burning in the creases of her eyes, but the filth on her fingers only made them sting more. Then it dawned on me, Mathenet continued, looking out to the recesses of the shuttered temple. What if he foresaw the inevitability of his empire's collapse? What if the Three Seas were doomed to unravel no matter who ruled them? You? Me? Feli? His blue eyes fairly bored through her. He seemed at peace with the great weights soaring about him, so broad did he appear in his white and gold vestments, so impressive were the accoutrements of his exalted station. She felt a rag-bound horse standing in his Dunyane shadow. Another childish human. If the Empire was doomed to perish, he said, what would his reasoning be then? The mob's roar heaved across the background the same as before, only marred with pitches that warbled across the limits of hearing. What are you saying? She heard herself cry. That he wanted me to fail? That he wanted the world, his home, to come crashing down upon his wife? His children? No, I'm saying he understood that such a crash would happen regardless. And so he chose one evil from among many. I don't believe it. I cannot. What kind of man made oil of his children? What kind of savior? Ask yourself, Esme, what is the purpose of the new empire? She had the sense of retreating from his words as before a sword point. To prevent the second apocalypse, she stammered. So if the great ordeal succeeds, what of the empire then? It has no... She swallowed. So painful was the word. Purpose. And if the great ordeal fails, Mathenet had asked, his woolen tone wrapped tight about the bruising iron of fact and reason. She found herself looking down to her feet, to the charcoal grime between her toes. Then the no-god walks, and... All eyes can feel him on the horizon. Every child is stillborn. Every man living knows that the Aspect Emperor, Anna Sarimba Kellis, spoke true. The world warred and rioted about them. She looked up without breath or volition. And men are united regardless. The sense of what he said struck her numb, even as the greater part of her balked. The great ordeal, the new empire, the second apocalypse. It all seemed some vast joke, a farce of monumental proportions. Maimara missing, Samarmis dead, Enrilitus dead, Kalmomis missing. These were the things that mattered, the enormities that preoccupied Mathenet possessed no rule that her heart could fathom. They were simply too immense, too distant to be thrown on the balance with something as utterly immediate as a child. They seemed little more than smoke before the fire of her children. Smoke that choked, that blinded, that led astray. Inescapable smoke. Killing. Mathenet stood clear and bright before her, at once her enemy and her champion. And her only hope, she suddenly realized, of understanding the ruthless madness of her husband. He killed him. He killed my... I made the exact mistake you yourself made, Esme, he said. I thought of the new empire as an end, something to be saved for its own sake, when it's really nothing more than a tool. The boom of strife and discord, the holy shrine of the thousand temples, graced her with a lingering look, as if satisfying himself that she had grasped the dire import of his ruminations. Then he turned his face to the high hanging gloom, called out to invisible ears, "We are finished!" he boomed. "The tusk and the mantle are reconciled." he has abandoned us, Esminet murmured into the ringing wake. When she blinked, it seemed she glimpsed the entire three seas burning. Nensivan, Invishi, Selukara, Carathusel. Mathanet nodded. For now, yes. She could hear a gathering of footfalls and hushed voices in the galleries. And after he destroys Gogalarath? The holy shrier glanced down at his palms. I don't know. Perhaps he would leave us to our own purposes. Her breath caught upon a pang. What would that be like? The first sobs blew through her as a breeze, soft, soothing even as they tousled her thought and vision. But the tempest was not long in coming. She found herself weeping in his expansive embrace, wailing at all the losses she had endured, all the uncertainties. How many revelations, she thought as the final gusts passed through her. How many revelations can one soul bear? For she had suffered far too many. She looked up into her shrier's bearded face, breathed deep the sweet bitter of his Shigeki myrrh. It seemed impossible that she had once seen malice in the gentle blue of his eyes. They kissed, not as lovers, but as a brother and a sister. She tasted tenderness on his lips. They gazed into each other's eyes, close enough to breathe the other's exhalations. Forgive me, the Shrier of a Thousand Temples said. The Empire roared and rioted unseen. She blinked, saw Imhalus's face unmade beneath pounding fists.
Maetha.
A glimpse was all he needed to fathom her question, so open was her face. Theli is safe, he said with a reassuring smile. Kel'Momas hides yet in the palace. Terror hooked her throat. Terror and crashing relief.
What? Alone?
His eyes seemed to lose focus, but even before she had registered it, he was there, before her, as immediate as her husband had ever been. He isn't what you think he is, Esme.
What do you mean?
He gestured to the floors behind her. In due time. She turned to the small crowd of Shrial and Imperial Operati, gathered about them, men she had known and trusted for many long years. N'Garao stood among them, Finursa, and even ancient Vem Mithridi. Some watched with expressions of hope, even joy, and some with apprehension. She was not surprised to see so many loyalties overturned. Mathanet was her husband's brother. In some dark corner of her soul she had prepared for this encounter. But the curses, the cat-spitting declarations of outrage, were nowhere to be found. Instead, she felt only exhaustion and relief.
Few things are as inexplicable as the concatenation of souls. Kellis had often told her how men glimpsed but a sliver of the intercourse that passed between them, how passions and rivalries and understandings they could scarce fathom drove their intercourse like galleys before a storm. Perhaps they were all exhausted. Perhaps they simply yearned for the life they had known before Mathanet and his coup. Perhaps they were frightened by the battling multitudes surrounding the temples. Perhaps they truly believed.
He isn't what you think he is. Whatever the reason, something happened as she regarded them. Despite the embroidered fanfare of their robes, despite their cosmetics and jeweled rings, despite the pride and ambition belonging to their exalted stations, they became mere men, bewildered and embattled equals, standing together in the absence of judgment that was their prophet's most beautiful gift. It did not matter who had erred, or who had betrayed, or who had injured. It did not matter who had died. They were simply disciples of Anisarimber Kellis, and the world clamored around them.
Mathanet resumed his position on the dais,
and Esmenet found herself watching him with a worshipper's simple wonder, blinking tears that did not sting. He seemed luminous, not simply with the overlapping rings of light shed by the hanging lantern wheels, but with renewal. And suddenly Esmenet realized that she could see her way past her losses and her hate. Somehow she knew they would find some way to hold the empire together, whether her accursed husband believed in them or not.
"We will stage an official reconciliation," Mathenet said in warm, informal tones. "Something for the masses, but for the nuns. I want all of you to witness what we said."
Then there he was, clad only in a loincloth, stepping between the golden idols of war and birth, stepping from where he had always been standing, in the one place that had escaped the notice of all, the one place overlooked, which exists in the world's every room. Her assassin. He stepped from the gloom. He looked hard, like something between brown flesh and gray stone. Three noiseless steps. Mathenet heard and turned. His face was emotionless, devoid of shock or surprise, or any expression. Somehow Esmenet knew he turned with little more than curiosity, so certain he was of his security. He turned just as the man dropped the knife between his neck and clavicle. There was nothing remarkable about the assault, no display of inhuman speed or ability, only a step from the one place overlooked to the one place unguarded. A kind of discharging of the inevitable. The figure instantly released the pommel. The holy shrier of the thousand temples gazed down at the knife as it were a hornet or a bee, teetered. Esmenet could only blink as Mathenet sputtered and died before her.
"Sister," he gasped, "you must tell my bro—"
He slumped to his knees, his eyes rounding about an emblematic emptiness, then crumbled to his side. His chest plate clattered against the polished tile. He died at her assassin's feet. Out of reflex, Esmenet turned to the abject faces, held out her hands to still the cries of cracked disbelief and the charge of the more warlike among the apparati. In the far pockets of gloom, she could see the Inchausti gathering into a golden rush. She could feel the Narinder motionless behind her. Why didn't he run?
"Hold!" she cried out. "I said hold!"
All those near fell silent and still. Some fairly flinched out of obedience.
"Vem Mithridi, does your fire still serve your empress?"
The old man hobbled to her side without hesitation. Sorcerous words seemed to cough out of the surrounding air. White light spilled from his puckered mouth and perforated eyes, made him seem an ancient baby for the vanishing of the rutted lines. Wards flickered to life about them. The nearest of the Inchausti began slowing to a wary trot, their broadswords still held on high.
"What you have witnessed is the work of our holy Aspect Emperor," she cried out, her voice strong for the iron of her exhaustion. She had no nerves to suffer. She knew what she must look like, beggared, wild and bloodied, wreathed in pale glowing tongues of flame. Nevertheless, she posed before them as though gowned in full imperial splendor, knowing the contradiction between bearing and appearance would smack of scripture. "The name Mathenet shall be stricken from all scrolls and all stone," she cried in righteous fury, "for he is naught but a deceiver."
She would do what her husband had bid her to do.
"The adoration you once felt, the dismay you now feel, is the very measure of his deception."
She would speak oil.
"He!" she shrieked, jerking her open hand to the bundle of fabric bleeding beneath the golden arc of idols. "Anna Sarimba Mathenet! He has revolted against his sacred brother! He has murdered our—"
Her voice broke about the truth of this last.
"Our holy prophet's son!"
The shrile and imperial apparati stood aghast, some stupefied, others terrified, a crowd of wise men and dandies trussed by mad circumstance. Beyond them, the Inchausti continued their clattering accumulation. Cries and moans and hissed conversations rose from them. One of their captains stepped belligerently forward, began,
"Who's
Anna Sarimba Callis?" she cried in scathing dismissal. "Our holy Aspect Emperor!" She could see the man's example leaping like contagion, emboldening others throughout the assembly. "To whom do you think he sends his holy dreams?" And though she could not sense them, she knew the Inchausti possessed Kore. She had to strike the will to fight from them. It was her only hope.
"Think!" she fairly screeched. "Who else would strike down the Shrier of the Thousand Temples with such ease? With such ease!"
This, she knew, would open a wedge.
"On your knees!" she cried,
as if she had conjured as much as invoked her divine husband.
"On your knees!"
Because acting and being were one and the same for men. She had no choice. She had to own the event. What chances did her assassin have of escape, even if he were Narinder? If captured, he would name her. She had to own the event and own it as justice, as the swift and brutal justice they had come to expect from Anna Sarimba Callis. The assassin would be spared, would be celebrated as a hero, as he should, since he had only worked his empress's will. This is why he remained standing over his victim. This was why he had chosen this very moment to strike. Many had fallen to their knees instantly, Finerza among them, the ghost of a smile upon his nimble face. Some groveled in abject shame, murmuring prayers to her where she stood beneath the golden idols. But a greater portion of the Inchausti remained standing, held up by their outrage and the example of their indecisive brothers.
"Kneel! For those who stand now, stand with foul god Gatarath!"
She would speak oil, heartbreaking oil. She would drive thousands to the executioner's sword if need be. She would burn Momon to the ground, the way the minstrels accused her of burning Carathuzel. Anything to see her children safe.
"For eternity itself hangs in the balance about you."
The last of the Inchausti relented, dropped to their knees, then to their faces. She watched it spread like a disease among them. The miraculous inversion that makes madness out of faith. The transformation of squalid catastrophe into divine revelation. And they could feel him, she knew. All of them could feel him emanating from her slight and bloodied figure. And in months and years hence, they would die thinking this the most significant, most glorious moment of their lives. Groveling before the Holy Empress. A feeling of triumph, unlike any she had ever experienced, steeped her to the merest vein. An elation that transcended her body. An uproarious continuity of self and subjugated world. It seemed she need only yank high her arms, and the very earth would be flat like a blanket. And she looked down with imperious satisfaction, reveled in the fleeting intensity. For even as she watched, the assembled penitents began looking about in wonder and anxious confusion. The roaring that had been her pious chorus, her proof of Mathanet's discord, had dwindled, then trailed away altogether. The mobs had fallen miraculously silent. And for the merest of instants, it seemed the whole empire had joined them on their knees. But something, a kind of rhythmic pulse, had taken its place, rising from the deep temple hollows. She recognized it instantly, though her soul refused to credit the knowledge. For it was a sound that still thrummed through the darkest of her dreams. Dreams of warring Shygik, of desert wastes, and the abject misery that was Karaskand. Dreams of holy Shaima, wrested from heathen hands. The beating of war drums, Fainim drums. The Empress of the Three Seas turned to the idol of a Nag Kay, who by some perversity of angles gleamed golden over the dead Shrya's inert form, the near-naked assassin, passionless at her side. She began laughing, clawing her hair and laughing. Such a devious whore was fate.